America looks ahead. Tonight, we present the 78th broadcast of Elliot Roosevelt's discussions of world affairs. These tri-weekly programs have come to you under the sponsorship of Emerson, world's largest maker of small radio, with 63 new 1940 quality sets for every purpose and every purse from $7.95 to $99.95 on easy terms. And now, Elliot Roosevelt.
Good evening, everyone. As you know by this time, one of the largest nations on Earth has moved in on the Finnish Republic. This helpless little country is now to be torn limb from limb by a mob of anti-religious and dictator-ridden people for no other reason than that the Finns are numerically weak and are therefore unable to defend themselves against such odds. This must be put down as another of Mr. Hitler's fine achievements, since it was he who opened the gates to communism in Europe and invited the Reds to help themselves. Yesterday, a man who looks upon Joseph Stalin as a new messiah delivered an address before the student body of Yale University. His name is Earl Browder. Mr. Browder is himself a self-confessed liar and a forger, and in due time he will be prosecuted by the government for what he proudly boasts to have done. At the time he was making his address, the jury hadn't yet returned with its unanimous verdict of guilty against Mr. Fritz Kuhn, the cornered leader of the German-American Bund. It hadn't yet proclaimed that Mr. Kuhn was a common thief and would therefore have to go to the penitentiary. Had Mr. Browder known this, it is possible that he would have spoken with less impudence to that gathering at Yale University. But the guilt of Mr. Kuhn was still legally in doubt, so he spoke in this wise. He said, "Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I forged my name to a passport. What's wrong in that? Many nice people give false names when they ask for passports. I don't see anything wrong in lying to the government when you want to leave the country." That's what Mr. Browder said by way of explanation to the charges the government will bring against him. As for Russia and the trouble she is having with the Finns, he thought Russia was exactly right to tell those Finns where to get off. After all, he pointed out, Russia has to defend herself. The Finns are violent and abusive. They constitute a threat to the whole future of the Soviet. Why, said he, Russia wants peace. Russia loves peace. All Russia wants to do is defend herself against those who would destroy her. That is the sort of nonsense Mr. Browder handed out at Yale. But the world isn't fooled. The world knows that for 20 years, Russia and Finland have lived side by side in complete harmony. The world knows that Finland has been too busy paying her honest debts to make trouble for any other nation. While the world was still at peace, Mr. Stalin and his mob would not have dared move in and attack anybody. It wouldn't have been safe. Some major power probably would have come in against her. But with Germany and France and Great Britain all locked in a death struggle, the time seemed right for the jackals to come out of their caves. That's why they leaped in and stabbed Poland in the back. That's why they moved in like a horde of mongrels and cut down a nation that had already been ripped to shreds. When the Germans made ready to go after Poland, they at least had a paper excuse to justify their actions. The Russians have no excuse. All they need is to find the helpless body. Then they move in and the rending begins. Knowing all this, it may be that we are really fortunate to have in our midst such idolizers of the Russian way as Mr. Earl Browder. His presence makes it easier for our opinions to crystallize. When he goes around trying to justify, with his little speeches, the mass exhibitions of gangsterism, such as the Soviets are showing now, he makes us realize how worthwhile our own precious liberties are, and how futile any government but a people's government must inevitably be. The government is going after Mr. Browder in a little while and ask him to explain to a jury why he chose to tell a lie when he sought a passport. He will be tried not for his political beliefs, but because he committed a forgery, because he broke the law, because he entered into activities that are illegal, and therefore, as an American citizen, he must produce satisfactory explanation or pay the penalty. It just happens that he is the secretary of the Communist Party of the United States. If he were a Methodist or a Democrat, he would be prosecuted just the same. By an odd coincidence, however, he is the second of the ISM's chiefs who has run afoul of the law. Mr. Fritz Kuhn, the other, is an American by adoption only. This places him in a more perilous position than Mr. Browder, who was lucky enough to be born here. Should the United States choose to revoke Kuhn's citizenship and deport him to Germany, it is probable that Hitler would have him beheaded. Hitler, as has been proved, hasn't much sympathy for muddlers and philanderers. By his loose behavior in America, Kuhn has brought the American Bund into an even lower esteem, if such a thing is possible, than it ordinarily would be. To the totalitarian mind such as Hitler's, this might easily be construed as an offense against the state. In the Reich, such offenders usually get the axe. So Mr. Browder might very well think of this and congratulate himself on being born in America. No matter what happens, we couldn't deport him even if we wanted to. And now, I want to mention a labor matter to you, but first a word from my sponsor. Some time ago, the National Labor Relations Board demanded the reinstatement of three employees who had been dismissed from a furniture company in Johnson City, Tennessee. When the case came before the United States Circuit Court of Appeals, it was unanimously decided that the National Labor Relations Board had grossly overstepped its authority. The board contended that the men were discharged for their union activities. It was this contention that drew from the court a scathing denunciation of the board's charges, saying, and I quote, "This not only flies in the face of the evidence produced by witnesses whose credibility is not impeached, but is in conflict with the evidence of the board's own representatives." Now, here was an instance of a CIO organization attempting to unionize employees in a small industry. As was perfectly legitimate and natural, the company refused to recognize the union as the bargaining agent for its employees until an election had been held. About that time, three men were dismissed for falling down on their jobs. Other men previously had been dismissed, just as men in all organizations are from time to time given their notices. But the moment these three men were discharged, the National Labor Relations Board held them up as men who were being persecuted and unfairly being dealt with by capital. The evidence was assembled. The charge was so palpably without foundation that the court then turned on the Labor Board with as vigorous a dressing down as it has ever been given. Now let's turn to a building project in another section of the country. A 40-story building was being erected. It was about half completed. After the workmen reached the 22nd story, a dispute arose as to the number of men who were to be used as plasterers. The men who were financing the project decided that the addition of a dozen extra men would be an unnecessary expense. They declined to authorize the addition of these names to the payroll. Whereupon a strike was called, and for 5 days not a single brick was laid or a nail driven. All work stopped, yet the enormous wastage and expense went on. There were supplies already contracted for, which had to be paid for. Each day's delay meant the loss of hundreds and even thousands of dollars. Where was the justification for behavior such as this? If action is taken against abuses such as this, the cry is raised that labor is being persecuted. If the public accedes to these demands, there is no end to them. One senseless demand follows in the steps of another. I personally believe that gangster tactics, so prevalent in certain departments of labor, are on the way out, if for no other reason than that the government is already taking steps to combat them. Vigorous prosecution of unions that operate illegally has been promised by Attorney General Murphy. Mr. William Green of the American Federation of Labor declares the government has no authority to prosecute under the antitrust laws. The government and the state always have the authority to prosecute corruption, graft, price fixing, and extortion wherever it exists. Hoodlums have no place in any decent labor organization, any more than they have any other place. I can tell you right now that until labor learns to police itself, it will be necessary from time to time for the people to do the policing themselves. There was a strike in Asheville, North Carolina, the other night. The strikers turned the power off. Asheville came into an utter and complete blackout. That's all very fine, but what about hospitals and operating rooms and maternity wards? What about the sick and the helpless in hundreds of homes? Are there as there always are in any city of size? No one knows how much irreparable harm a single blackout like this can cause. I think that labor with a just grievance always has the right to strike. That right is guaranteed in the Constitution. But I think that a warning period should always be set, say of 30 days. If capital knew that at the end of an allotted time, workers would walk out, more often than not a just compromise could be reached. But the senseless calling of impromptu strikes, without notice to the public, with their hardships and their undeserved penalties, which they impose on innocent people, is intolerable and un-American. The men who drew up the Constitution never intended that whole sections of society should be penalized because two opposing factions couldn't or wouldn't settle their differences over a council table.